case 12-2101, and that is the United States versus Rosen. Good morning. How are you?
Very fine, Your Honor.
Mr. Stenger, hi.
Hello. The court. The first issue that I'd like to address is my issue two. I raised three issues in the brief with some subsets, but the issue two is that the district court erred in finding that Mr. Rosen was an organizer or a leader of a criminal activity involving five or more participants, or that was otherwise extensive pursuant to United States Sentencing Guidelines 3B1.1. This case involved a situation unlike any of the cases that have been cited in the government's brief. Particularly at the sentencing hearing, both sides cited the case of United States versus Waz. And it's an instructive case, I believe, with respect to the present case. But I believe that the government relies on it when it should not. With respect to the particular facts on the record in this case, it's clear that the relationship that Mr. Rosen had with any other participants was a relationship that was characterized by a symbiotic relationship, mutually profitable, that it was an exchange that was defined by the terms of each of the relationships, and that these relationships were between Mr. Rosen and these individuals as autonomous individuals.
But did he recruit these individuals?
Your Honor, I would say that would depend upon what the court would consider recruitment. Mr. Rosen was attempting to do various things. One of the things that he wanted to do was attempt to get financing. So in the process of attempting to get financing, for example, he went to an accountant, and he paid the accountant $1,500 to produce tax returns. The tax returns were not accurate, but that was a relationship, albeit distasteful, but a relationship that existed between he and the accountant, with the accountant perhaps not even knowing, it's unclear on the record, with the accountant perhaps not even knowing who this, you know, who the inaccurate returns were going to be directed to and for what purpose. So really, that relationship really doesn't stop there. And with respect to the accountant, he had no degree of control over the accountant. It was not a situation where the accountant was going to be receiving some percentage of the ultimate contemplated money. He was going to be...
Loot might be the word you're looking for.
Pardon me?
Loot might be the word you're looking for.
Well, I'll say contemplated money. He was not going to receive anything that was contemplated as part of the scheme. He was receiving his contracted rate. There was really no direct or indirect control that Mr. Rosen would have had over the accountant. And the same went for Richard Kalla and Steve Stanton, who were two other individuals that were involved. And in that case, that was for a document that Mr. Rosen believed would evidence his financing. He paid what essentially amounted to $30,000 for that document. In that situation, that was a contract, essentially, that was negotiated between Richard Kalla and Steve Stanton and Mr. Rosen. And, in fact, I think that there was even some evidence of a negotiation that actually took place as to how much that was going to cost them in order for them to produce that document for him. And, once again, it was an independent association. It was mutually beneficial. But at no time did Mr. Rosen, who I believe at that time was in his late 70s, and physically somewhat frail at that time with deteriorating health, was in some way controlling them or directing them in what they were doing. It was much the same with Arthur Johnson, who was another participant in the case. And it went also to Nicholas Serra, who had submitted a false lien waiver. At no time did Mr. Rosen direct the activities of these individuals or have any type of control over them. It was basically multiple, essentially, contracts that he had arranged with these particular individuals.
How is his age and deteriorating health relevant to the question of whether he's a leader or organizer?
Well, Your Honor, I would liken it to the situation that we often see in a drug case where you have some type, and I know that these are not dispositive terms from the cases, but since the court has asked, we see cases where, in a drug case where there's a kingpin or a drug lord who has some type of leverage over other individuals, and he uses or she uses that leverage to control the other individuals and get essentially the other individuals to do what that particular person wants them to do. But here we don't have that situation. We have a person who was visibly frail, a person who was not really in any position to exert any type of, you know, when we talk about control, we think of leverage and sort of making someone do what you want them to do, and he really had no way to do that other than what I've talked about.
And he couldn't physically overpower them.
He certainly wasn't going to physically overpower anyone,
shoot him,
Your Honor.
He?
Pardon me?
He could shoot him if he wanted to.
He could have, but there was certainly no evidence that or anything on
well,
the record to suggest it, that he had
a realm of speculation of frail people.
There was
frail
nothing.
People kill people.
There was nothing on the record to suggest that anything like that was going on.
Yeah.
And that was any part of the dynamic of the case. But, contrasted from
he
the
uses
Wise...
his brains, not his hand.
Not...
Contrasted from the Wise case where we had the pawn shop owners and the thieves. The thieving accomplices in that case, were told essentially what they should steal. They were front-ended money to take trips to get the stolen goods as part of an ongoing scheme. They were instructed even in material aspects to remove tags from various items. And in that case, the Wazes, the husband and wife, actually played a facilitating role, whereas here Mr. Rosen merely contracted with the separate individuals and had separate associations with them, not part of a unitary scheme, but rather these separate associations that were all mutually beneficial.
Could I ask you this? Did he actually have the means and ability to build any development at all? In other words, if he had managed to perpetrate his scheme, would there be a housing development today, albeit of shoddy quality? But
well, Your Honor, that's hard to say. Analytically, this is sort of where I stop, and I think that this is relevant to the inquiry of what the intended loss is, and perhaps it's relevant to 18 U.S.C. 3553. But we have a situation where the FAA had the 8 conditions that are set forth in order for Mr. Rosen to proceed in receiving what would have otherwise been and what the government argues is the fruits of his crime. So if we take the $1.9 million, we have a situation where the actual loss to the city was approximately $66,000. And essentially, in order for Mr. Rosen to have come anywhere near even the $1 million or anything between $128,000 and $1 million, and $128,000 being the draw request that he had made, it would have been basically impossible, because at some point someone's going to look, because one of the conditions was that he had to show some sort of progress in the completion of the project in order to receive the funds from the city. So basically, he would have been caught very early on, very much prior to the $1 million, and as it turned out, he was stopped at the $128,000 mark. See, I've eaten into some of my time here.
Thank you. Mr. Weinhoft, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Well.
Good morning. My name is Steve Weinhoft. I'm here on behalf of the United States. May it please the court. The defendant raises 3 issues in his brief, none of which justify reversal of the 48-month sentence imposed by the district court which represents both a downward departure and a below-guideline sentence. The government asks this court to affirm that sentence. I'll begin on the second issue, as the defendant did, and begin first with the standard of review.
Before you do that,
yes, ma'am.
What was his actual business experience?
Printing.
Is there any evidence that he ever? I mean,
he had never developed a single housing project.
What is, you know?
Yeah, not one. He had been involved in printing, and he had been involved to a limited extent in some demolition, but he had never constructed a single housing project.
He tore them down, not built them up.
Yeah, he hadn't built a single one yet, though. And so he did have some basic, I guess, knowledge of construction, but certainly no experience.
What's going on down there with the St. Louis Dispatch post that they would print this news story? I mean, what?
That is absolutely remarkable. The only term that comes to mind is chutzpah from this defendant when you look at his conduct. He literally, and I don't know how he made the contact with the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, but he convinced them, and they ran a story, crediting him with building a $40 million power plant in the Philippines as a trash-to-energy plant, is how it was marketed. And he submitted that newspaper story in conjunction with his application to build the Bowman Estates project, in part to establish his credentials as a serious businessman.
Well, you might want to meet with them and tell them they need some investigative reporters, because this is just beyond the pale.
It is absolutely remarkable that was able to go to press. But what's even more remarkable is that defendant would submit that in conjunction with his application for more than $1.9 million of public funding. And that $1.9 million, as you asked the question of counsel on whether or not at the end of the day would there be a housing project, even of shoddy quality, I think the answer to that's a resounding no. He had no expertise, no ability, and more importantly, no financial wherewithal to make this happen. The project edge budgeted was, I believe, about $5.6 million. He was supposed to bring more than $3.6 million of his own money into the project. He didn't have that. His net worth in the PSR, I believe, was reflected at $7,400, if memory serves. He had absolutely no financial wherewithal whatsoever for this to happen. But it's even worse when you consider that his own analyst that came in and reviewed the project after it had been approved pointed out to him that it was $2.7 million underwater.
But you just said a very interesting word, approved. Who would approve this?
It was approved entirely based on false representations. I entirely agree with you, which is why, quite frankly, the public corruption component to this case that involved a bribe paid to the Director of Community Development makes this an even more aggravated case. It went through. It had the support of, as the district court said, the city fathers in East St. Louis, and they've put a tremendous amount of pressure on the Financial Advisory Authority to approve this project.
There are city fathers in East St. Louis?
That's the phrase used by the district court. He was talking about the senior staff, the mayor of East St. Louis, as well as the director of community development. But the answer to your question is no. This project never would have been built. The entire $1.9 million.
Wasn't the city in bankruptcy not too long ago?
Well, it was worse than that. It was so far under water they had no ability to provide even the most basic services to that city. Trash was stacking up on because they couldn't afford to pay for garbage collection. The city police department was underfunded to the point where it practically did not exist. And the city passed. The city requested help under the Financially Distressed Cities Act, and that provided for, I believe it was about an $80 million bailout for the city to try and get that city back on track. And one of the conditions of that huge investment by the state was that the Financial Advisory Authority, which is a state agency, was then created and imposed to oversee spending. So not only did spending have to be approved.
And did they oversee it?
Yes, actually, but for the actions of the FAA, the losses in this case probably would have been much, much greater. The FAA, really, in my view, is to be commended in the case. But there's beyond just the obvious misrepresentations and his total inability to complete the project, the district court's finding of loss of in excess of $1 million is supported on many, many levels, one of which, and the most compelling, is the price differential inherent in this bait beat-and-switch scheme. He had contracted to stick build, actually physical construction with 2x4s and on-site construction, but instead he contracted with a manufacturer of prefab housing from the state of Indiana to supply less expensive construction than that which was contracted for, and the difference was well in excess of $1 million there. So the loss amount, in my view, is not an issue. Not only does the defendant have to show clear error, he has to show that the district court's calculations were not only inaccurate, but outside of the realm of possible computations, and he certainly cannot make that showing.
Is he in prison?
Not yet. He was sentenced. He had a report date, but actually after sentencing, but before his report date, he reported that he had suffered a heart attack. So report date was extended, and I know there was another motion filed last week, and it's something that we're obviously trying to look at with in a good faith manner.
Is he still 81?
I believe I don't think he's turned 82, but I think 81 is the general.
Would you quickly address the organizer or leader?
Certainly.
Position that these are all just independent contractors?
Certainly. Absolutely not. There's when the defendant talks, counsel uses the example of a drug kingpin. I wrote down a couple of his words. He talked about someone in a leader organizer having to exert leverage, having to exert authority, and he used the phrase making someone do something, which, of course, is another word for compulsion. That's not the test for a leader or organizer. A leader or an organizer is a factual question about there's a couple of cases. The Knox case, 624 F3rd 865, the district court used a really instructive phrase there. The straw that stirs the drink. Is this the person who had the most culpability? Was this the straw that stirs the drink? In the Peterson-Knox case, the district court found that adjustment was proper because the defendant was the heart, soul, and main artery of the fraud. Certainly, that's the case here. This is not a situation where you have a series of incoherent, isolated, random acts of criminality. This case, what the stipulation of facts shows, and what the indictment alleges is a single scheme, one single scheme, and it's not a complicated scheme. It was simply to defraud the East St. Louis Advisory Authority of TIF funding, which was local, and federal funding from Housing and Urban Development, and to obtain those funds through fraud to develop the Bowman Estates program. The defendant was found, and the most important, in my view, factual finding by the district court was that, as a matter of fact, and this is a quote, Mr. Rosen literally participated or directed every part of the scheme. He was actively involved in every portion of it. Conversely, there were no criminal acts that were unveiled that were directed with anyone else without his active participation or knowledge. The district court went through really an exemplary description of each of those seven factors that are enumerated in the adjustment and when making the factual determination of whether or not an individual is an organizer or leader. And each of those facts clearly showed that this defendant is the one who stood to gain. This was the defendant who set every one of those criminal acts into motion. Each of the accomplices and co-conspirators that were referenced in the pleadings and even referenced by counsel, whether it's the financiers, Mr. Callum, Mr. Staten, the accountant, Arthur Johnson, none of those people came to Mr. Rosen seeking him out for criminal activity. It was the converse. The defendant went and reached out to every one of those other co-conspirators and accomplices, and he was the one that set each one of those criminal acts into motion. And each one of those criminal acts was directed at one single scheme, and that was a scheme to defraud the city and its in the funding of the Bowman Estates in the Bowman Estates case. And the most recent word from this circuit on the test is from the Vasquez case, which states the defendant must have exercised some degree of control over others, or he must have been responsible for organizing others. And clearly, under either test, Mr. Rosen clearly qualifies for the adjustment. And the standard of review, being as deferential as it is, in the Robertson case, the standard of review was really outcome determinative because of the fact that under either test, the defendant couldn't overcome and show clear error. The leader-organizer adjustment exists for the purpose of assigning relative culpability amongst defendants, and there's no question whatsoever that this defendant was the most culpable and the individual who organized the entire crime And lastly, I see my time is about to expire. Just to briefly mention the third issue, the reasonableness. I would just be remiss if I didn't point out that the defendant is quite literally asking for something which is unprecedented, finding that a sentence which represents both a downward departure and a below-guideline sentence is substantively unreasonable. That's just simply without precedent. Thank you.
Yeah.
Your Honors, if I may, I will just try to boil down essentially the facts that I would like to stress to the Court. We have, and this is meant by no means to trivialize what we're dealing with here today, but we have a situation of an 81-year-old person. He has a wife that is in failing health. He was her primary caregiver. We have that same individual, the defendant in this case, having terrible heart failure, basically in very deteriorating health, and we have a situation where the city of East St. Louis suffered an actual loss of $66,000. We have draws that were made in the amount of approximately $128,000, and I would argue to the Court that we have a situation where we have a scheme that was really never going anywhere, particularly with respect to the eight conditions that the FAA had placed upon money draws that Mr. Rosen that he would have essentially had to show completion of particular items in order to actually receive that money. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Stenger, because you were court-appointed, and my goodness, thank you very much for the job you did for Mr. Rosen. Thank you. The case will be taken under advisement.